Have you ever stopped to think, I mean, really think, about what connects, say, a business making a big decision, a grandmaster playing chess, and, well, even the way our cities grow?
It seems like a stretch, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But there's this fascinating thread running through them.
Exactly. And today we're diving deep into some really thought-provoking sources that explore this very connection. We're talking about the nature of the artificial, basically, anything humans design or make.
And maybe surprisingly, the simplicity that often lies hidden inside really complex systems.
Our mission really is to pull out those key insights, those nuggets that can help you see the world around you, maybe even yourself, in a totally new light. Perhaps even change how you tackle
Yeah,
problems.
we'll be exploring a core idea that honestly challenges how we usually think about human creations and maybe even human thought itself.
So we'll look at how things are artificial, but in a very specific way. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not fake, but shaped by goals, by purpose, designed to fit into an environment. It's different from things just governed by natural laws.
And what's amazing is how this perspective, this lens, sheds light on so much economics, how our minds work.
Pretty much everything human influence.
Okay, so let's unpack that term artificial first,
Right.
because like you said, it's not about being fake or, second rate.
Not at all. The sources are really clear. It's neutral. It just means man-made as opposed to natural. Simple as that.
And that distinction is crucial.
Absolutely key. Think about natural stuff like gravity. It has this air of necessity, right? It just follows the laws of physics. Can't be any other way.
Okay, makes sense.
But artificial things, they have an air of contingency. They could be different. They're shaped by goals, by the environment they're meant for.
So they're malleable.
Precisely. And this brings up a huge question the sources grapple with. Can you even have a science of things that just might be possible, not just a science of how things are right now?
A science of the possible. Interesting. So how do we think about these artificial things then? Like an artifact, an object.
The sources use a great metaphor. Think of an artifact as an interface.
An interface, like a computer interface.
Sort of, yeah. It's a meeting point. It connects an inner environment, the thing's own structure, how it's built, with an outer environment where it actually works, its surroundings.
Okay, inner and outer.
And if the inner structure fits the outer environment well enough,
Yeah.
it does its job. It serves its purpose.
Right, like a key fitting a lock.
Right.
The inner shape matches the outer shape it needs to interact with.
Exactly. And this leads to a really powerful idea. Often, you can figure out how an artificial system will behave just by knowing its goals and the environment it's in.
Without needing to know all the nitty-gritty details inside.
Often, yes, with just, minimal assumptions about the internal workings.
Wow. So, like, different kinds of clocks.
Perfect example, a grandfather clock driven by weights and a modern quartz clock driven by a battery, totally different insides.
Completely different.
But in the same environment, our standard flow of time, they achieve the same goal, telling time. Or think birds versus airplanes. Different mechanisms, same goal of flight in our atmosphere.
Okay, I see. And this applies to organizations too, like businesses.
It does. The sources say if you assume a business aims to maximize profit, that's its goal, and then the government adds a sales tax that changes the outer environment, you can predict the business will likely raise its prices.
Even without knowing their exact accounting software or who makes the pricing decisions internally.
Exactly. Because the goal and the environment constrain the behavior, assuming that profit motive holds.
That's a really interesting way to simplify things. But I wonder, does it sometimes oversimplify? What if a business isn't just about profit? Or what if the internal stuff really matters?
That's a fair challenge, and the sources don't ignore that complexity. But the core argument holds for many situations, and it leads directly into thinking about design.
Right, you mentioned fields like engineering, medicine, business. These aren't just applied science in this view.
No, they're fundamentally about design. They're about figuring out how things ought to be or might be to achieve certain goals, not just describing how they currently are.
So, the science of the artificial and the science of design, they're linked.
Completely. The possibility of creating a science of design, the sources argue, is exactly as strong as the possibility of creating a science of the artificial. They stand or fall together.
And what would a science of design look like?
It focuses on that adaptation process, how means get fitted to environments. It's about finding intellectually solid, analyzable, teachable ways to think about the design process itself.
Okay, so it involves tools like understanding rational choice, utility theory.
Yeah, things like utility theory, how people ideally make choices to get what they want most. and computational methods, ways to search for the best, the optimal solutions.
But, and this seems important, it's not always about finding the absolute best solution, is it?
No, absolutely not. This is a key point. Often it's about finding solutions that are just good enough. The term used is satisficing.
Satisficing. So settling for satisfactory, not necessarily optimal.
Exactly. Because finding the absolute best might be impossible or just take way too much time and effort. Good enough often works fine.
Okay, but how do you even design something if the options aren't all laid out neatly in front of you? If you're satisficing, not optimizing from a known set.
That's where it gets really interesting. The sources stress that finding satisfactory actions often means you have to search for alternatives. Sometimes even invent or synthesize new ones. You're not just picking from menu A, B, or C.
You have to create the menu sometimes.
Precisely. It's a creative, constructive process, not just analytical. Think about that business. Sometimes the breakthrough isn't optimizing an existing process, but inventing a whole new way of doing things that's simply good enough to disrupt the market.
Okay, this next idea, it really made me pause. The sources propose this hypothesis.
The ant hypothesis.
Yeah. It basically says, human beings, viewed as behaving systems, are quite simple.
Which sounds wrong initially. We feel complex.
Right. But then it says, the apparent complexity of our behavior over time is largely a reflection of the complexity of the environment in which we find ourselves.
So, like the ant tracing a complex path on the beach. It's not because the ant has complex navigation rules. It's because the beach itself, the sand, is uneven and complex. The ant's rules are simple. Go around obstacles.
Apply to us. Wow. It suggests maybe our internal mental machinery is simpler than we think, and our complex behavior comes from trying to deal with a complex world.
That's the core idea. And it implies that to understand human behavior, maybe we don't need a hyper-detailed map of every neuron.
Just a general idea of our limits, our processing constraints.
Exactly. A broad understanding of our information processing limits might be enough. And these limits define what the sources call bounded rationality.
Bounded rationality. Our reason is limited. What are some of those key limits?
Well, psychology experiments highlighted in the sources point to some pretty stark ones. Our short-term memory, for instance, is tiny.
Like the famous 7 ± 2 chunks.
Yeah, or maybe even less. Some studies suggest maybe only 2 or 3 things we can actively juggle at once. And getting something into long-term memory isn't instant either.
How long does it take?
The estimate is around 8 seconds per chunk. Think about that. 8 seconds to really lock in one piece of information.
No wonder I forget names right after I hear them sometimes. Or, yeah, walk into a room and forget why. That limit is hitting hard.
It really is. And it helps explain things that seem almost magical, like chess grandmasters.
Right. They glance at a complex board for maybe 5 seconds.
And they can reconstruct it almost perfectly. While a novice player struggles to remember more than a few pieces.
So it's not photographic memory?
Nope. It's pattern recognition. They aren't seeing individual pieces. They're seeing familiar chunks, patterns they've learned over years.
How many patterns are we talking?
The estimate is huge. Maybe 50,000 chunks of chess knowledge? That's comparable to the vocabulary of a well-educated person in their native language.
50,000. And that takes, what, about 10 years?
Roughly a decade of really intensive study and practice to build up that kind of expertise, that vocabulary of patterns.
So what we often call intuition, especially in experts, might just be this incredibly fast pattern recognition built on thousands of learned chunks.
Very likely, yes. It feels like magic, but it's built on deep learning.
And this also relates to how we learn generally, right? Meaningful learning versus rote memorization.
Definitely. Learning things meaningfully, understanding connections, indexing information well, maybe even storing it as a procedure, like how to do something that sticks much better than just memorizing isolated facts. It's more robust, more easily retrieved.
So back to the core idea. If our basic mental operations are relatively simple, limited by things like short-term memory and chunking, why does our behavior seem so incredibly complex sometimes?
Again, the hypothesis points outwards. It's often the sheer complexity of the task or the environment we're trying to navigate and adapt to. Our simple rules interact with a complex world, producing complex-looking results.
Okay, let's scale this up. How does this bounded rationality and satisficing play out in big systems, like the economy? Classical economics often assumes we're hyper-rational optimizers, right?
It does. The idealized economic man always makes the choice that maximizes their utility or profit, with perfect information and unlimited calculation power.
Which doesn't sound very much like real people.
Not really. And the sources argue that a model based on satisficing, aiming for good enough, actually fits the real-world data much better. It acknowledges our cognitive limits.
So the amazing thing about markets isn't that they achieve perfect optimization.
Because they probably don't.
Yeah.
The marvel is that they often clear it all that buyers find sellers and prices emerge that kind of work, even with all this bounded rationality and imperfect information swirling around.
And competition plays a role here, even if firms aren't consciously optimizing.
Right. In a competitive environment, firms that happen to act as if they are maximizing profit, or at least satisficing effectively, might be more likely to survive. It looks like optimization from the outside, but the internal process might be much simpler, more rule of thumb based.
This connects to another fascinating idea in the sources: order without a planner.
Yes. Like those medieval cities you mentioned earlier. They weren't designed by a single master architect with a grand blueprint.
They just evolved.
They evolved organically. Ugh. Individuals and small groups made local decisions, responding to immediate needs and opportunities, and somehow a functioning city emerged over time. Markets are seen similarly.
So markets self-regulate through feedback loops, avoiding the need for some central planner to calculate everything.
Exactly. Imagine the impossible computational task if someone had to plan out every transaction. Markets, like many natural systems, use decentralized information and feedback to create a kind of spontaneous order.
Even in something like the Prisoner's Dilemma game, does bounded rationality play out differently there?
It's a great example. If both players are perfectly rational and self-interested, the logical outcome is often mutual defection, which is bad for both. Treachery seems optimal.
Right, the classic trap.
But if players use simpler, boundedly rational strategies like tit for tat, just copy what the other guy did last time, you can actually end up with much more cooperation and better outcomes for everyone involved.
So our cognitive limitations might actually help us cooperate sometimes.
It's a provocative thought, isn't it? That perfect, cold rationality might be socially destructive in some contexts, while simpler, adaptive rules lead to more stable, beneficial interactions.
And inside organizations, there's another non-purely rational factor the sources highlight: loyalty, identification.
Yes, organizational loyalty or identification. People often make decisions that benefit the organization, even sometimes at their own personal expense.
That doesn't sound like pure self-interest maximization.
Not at all. The sources call this tendency docility, not in a negative sense, but meaning a willingness to learn from and align with group or organizational goals. And they argue this isn't just, you know, a nice to have.
It's essential.
Absolutely essential for complex organizations to function. It allows for decentralization. You don't need the boss micromanaging every decision if people generally try to do what's best for the team or the company. It massively boosts the organization's overall problem-solving capacity.
Okay, shifting gears slightly, but related to problem-solving. When we face a problem, any problem, the first step is always understanding it, right? What does that mean according to these sources?
It means creating a representation of the problem in your mind, finding a way to frame it, to structure it.
And the way you represent it matters hugely.
Enormously. There's a great example in the sources, a game called Number Scrabble.
Never heard of it. Sounds complicated.
It can seem that way. Players take turns picking numbers from 1 to 9, and the first to get 3 numbers that add up to 15 wins.
Okay. Yeah, seems tricky to track all the combinations.
But then someone realizes it's mathematically identical and isomorph to a much simpler game.
Which one?
Tic-tac-toe. If you arrange the numbers 1 to 9 in a 3x3 magic square, where every row, column, and diagonal adds up to 15.
Then picking numbers that sum to 15 is exactly the same as getting 3 in a row in tic-tac-toe.
Precisely. Once you see that representation, the game becomes trivial if you know how to play tic-tac-toe. The solution was hidden by the initial representation.
So a huge part of solving difficult problems might just be finding the right way to look at them, the right representation.
A very significant part, yes.
Yeah.
Change the representation, change the problem.
This even links to how we visualize things, the mind's eye.
It does. Think about an economist sketching a supply and demand graph.
Okay, yeah, standard tool.
They're using a visual spatial representation to understand relationships and derive conclusions like where the equilibrium price is. They could derive the same answer using algebra equations.
But the graph uses a different kind of mental computation, visual processing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Different representations enable different computational paths, even if they lead to the same answer. The mind uses multiple ways to process information.
And this connects even to language and AI.
There's a fascinating parallel drawn. Both modern linguistics, particularly Chomsky's transformational grammar, and these information processing theories of thinking view the mind as dealing with hierarchically organized structures, like nested lists or tree structures.
Okay, so language has this deep structure.
And thought processes seem to operate on similar structures. This common ground helps explain how we connect language to meaning.
Like resolving ambiguity.
Yes. The classic example, I saw the man on the hill with the telescope. Who has the telescope?
Right. Could be me, could be the man. Ambiguous grammar.
But our knowledge of the world, the meaning, semantics, usually tells us it's more likely I used the telescope to see the man. We use meaning to solve the structural ambiguity. Our mental processing integrates structure and meaning seamlessly.
So we've talked about complexity arising from simple agents in complex environments, but what about inherently complex systems themselves? How do we even begin to understand them?
The key insight here is the idea of hierarchical systems, or sometimes called nearly decomposable systems.
Hierarchical, like an organization chart, levels within levels.
Exactly like that. Or think of a building. It's made of floors, which are made of rooms, which contain furniture. Or a biological organism. Systems, organs, tissues, cells.
Okay, so layers of organization. What does nearly decomposable mean?
It means these systems are built from subsystems that are pretty stable on their own, and the interactions between the subsystems are weaker or less frequent than the interactions within a subsystem.
So the rooms in a building interact more strongly internally, people moving within them, than they do with rooms on a different floor, perhaps.
Precisely. The components within a subsystem stick together, operate somewhat independently. And this structure is absolutely crucial for our ability to understand complexity.
Why? Because we don't have to track every single tiny interaction across the whole system.
Exactly. We can analyze it level by level, understand the rooms, then how the floors connect, then the whole building. If everything interacted strongly with everything else all the time, it might just be impossible to grasp. This near decomposability is a huge simplifying factor.
And this structure also helps explain how complex things can evolve or be built in the first place.
Yes. There's a wonderful parable in the sources about two watchmakers, Hora and Tempus.
Okay.
Hora builds his watches piece by tiny piece. If he gets interrupted, the whole thing falls apart and he has to start over. Tempus, however, builds stable subassemblies, maybe groups of 10 gears first. Then he puts the subassemblies together.
So if Tempus gets interrupted while putting two subassemblies together, he only loses that one step. The finished subassemblies are still fine.
Exactly. So Tempus finishes watches much, much faster and more reliably than Hora. Hierarchy provides stability and speeds up construction or evolution.
It's like that analogy of opening a combination safe, too, isn't it?
The clicking safe, yes.
Yeah.
If you have 100 dial safe and each dial clicks when it's in the right position, you can open it relatively quickly by listening for the clicks.
But if it's a blind safe where you only find out if it's open when all 100 dials are correct?
The search space is astronomically huge. It would take practically forever. Hierarchy, or getting feedback on subproblems, makes intractable problems manageable.
So complexity isn't always just a tangled mess. If it's structured hierarchically, it can actually be described quite simply because of that structure, that redundancy.
Right. You can describe it using a state description, like defining all the points of a circle, or a process description, like explaining how to draw it with a compass. Different ways to capture the same complex reality made possible by its underlying structure.
Okay, bringing these ideas together. If we understand artificial systems, design, bounded rationality, complexity, why is social planning so hard? If we can design rockets to land on the moon, why can't we easily design, say, a perfectly peaceful society?
The moon landing comparison. The sources point out a critical difference. Going to the moon, while technically difficult, was relatively simple in another dimension. It had a single, very clear operational goal: get there and back safely. And crucially, the environment physics engineering constraints was complex, but essentially cooperative, or at least predictable. It wasn't actively trying to thwart the plan.
Okay, I see the contrast coming. Social planning is different.
Vastly different. First, you rarely have a single goal. You have multiple, often conflicting goals. Think about urban planning. Do you prioritize affordable housing, green spaces, traffic flow, economic development? They often trade off against each other.
Right. Stakeholders want different things.
Exactly. Then there's the data problem that's often inadequate or unreliable. And maybe the biggest challenge, the system reacts to the plan.
People change their behavior based on the policy.
Yes. What the sources call gaming behavior. People adapt. They find loopholes, they respond in unexpected ways, sometimes completely neutralizing the policy's intended effect. The social environment is adaptive and often adversarial, not passive like the laws of physics.
The Marshall Plan after World War II is mentioned as an example of these complexities.
Yes, the organizational challenges there showed how different ways of representing the problem. Was it about shipping goods, rebuilding industry, political stability, led to different strategies and outcomes? The representation mattered hugely.
And our own bounded rationality trips us up here too, especially with long-term planning.
Definitely. We tend to discount the future heavily.
Meaning we care more about now than later?
Much more. Proximate consequences, things happening soon, loom much larger in our decision-making than distant ones. Which makes sense from an evolutionary perspective, perhaps, but it makes coherent long-term social planning incredibly difficult. We prioritize the immediate fix over the sustainable solution.
It's a very human bias.
It is, and it leads to this final, somewhat unsettling question the sources raise. Does social progress really exist in a linear way?
What's the alternative view?
The idea of myopic hill climbing. Like biological evolution, social change might just be a process of always trying to find a slightly better state than the current one based on immediate pressures.
Like climbing a hill in fog, you keep going up, but you have no idea if you're heading towards the highest peak or just a local maximum.
Exactly. You're aiming for a fitter near future, but there's no guarantee of reaching some ultimate optimum, or even that the direction is consistently better in the grand scheme of things.
So no guaranteed long-run progress towards perfection.
Perhaps not in a predetermined way. However, the sources do observe a general long-run trend in both biological evolution and social systems towards increased variety and complexity. Things tend to get more differentiated, more intricate over time, even if it's not directed towards a single goal.
Wow. Okay, we have covered a lot of ground today. It feels like we've really journeyed through some deep concepts.
We certainly have. From defining the artificial to exploring the limits of our own minds and the structure of complexity itself.
So just to recap the big threads, artificiality isn't bad. It's just human-made, shaped by goals and environment.
Right. And our bounded rationality, our cognitive limits, isn't necessarily a flaw, but a fundamental feature that shapes everything from individual decisions to economic systems, sometimes even leading to cooperation.
And complexity. It's often not an irreducible tangle, but has a hidden simplicity, usually through hierarchy or near decomposability, which is what makes complex systems understandable and even possible.
I think the core takeaway is that we can learn a huge amount by looking at systems. Any system, really, through this lens of inner structure, outer environment, goals, and those fundamental information processing limits.
Focusing not just on how things are, but how they adapt, how they're designed, how they might be.
Exactly. The power of design and understanding the design process.
And maybe the most profound thought, for me at least, is that the incredible complexity we see in human behavior and our organizations, our whole society.
Yeah.
Maybe it stems less from complicated instructions inside us.
And more from relatively simple agents, us, constantly interacting with and adapting to incredibly complex environments.
The ant on the beach, writ large.
In a way, yes. So maybe the next time you encounter something complex, a thriving city, someone with amazing skills, even just puzzling through a tough decision yourself.
Ask. What are the simple processes here? And what's the complex environment they're wrestling with? How is the inner adapting to the outer?
That could be a really powerful question to ask. It shifts the focus.
Well, that's all the time we have for this deep dive. We really hope it's giving you plenty to think about, maybe spark some new connections or questions in your own mind.
Hopefully it's a useful lens for looking at the world.